Well, good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, June 24th. I'm Ray Graff. Today we talk about the great outdoors, which is really inviting because I just spent an hour in a meeting, and this is going to be fun. More specifically, we'll talk about wildlife in your backyard, in your neighborhood, in your town. We welcome back Jeremy Hurst. Jeremy serves as the Game Management Section Head for the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. Also with us today, Josh Stiller. Josh coordinates the statewide migratory and upland game bird program for the DEC. If you want to be a part of the conversation today, give us a call. If you care, leave them there. We'll talk about that. Give us a shout, 800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Jeremy, Josh, your wildlife questions coming up. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We're discussing wildlife today with Jeremy Hurst of the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. Jeremy is the DEC's big game unit leader, I think, although my information might be very old, in the Albany headquarters. He also helps provide oversight of the white-tailed deer, black bear, moose management programs for the state, which includes working with biologists, facilitating research efforts with universities, etc. Also with us today is Josh Stiller, who at one time was the statewide migratory and upland game bird program head, but who knows what he does now. I should really check beforehand. The number to call is 800-348. We're going to find out what he does. The number is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Jeremy Hurst, what is it that you do? Was that pretty correct? Are you still the big game
unit? It was
unit
correct there? At one time.
It's not anymore.
No, we need to update the bios.
You know, I'm...
That's our fault.
Well, whatever. What do you do now?
So now I oversee the game management program for the state. So I supervise the biologists that run our small game program and our big game program and our hunter education program.
So this, you still work at the DEC?
I do. Indeed.
Well, welcome to the show, Dan.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
What about you, Stiller? Do you still work for the DEC?
I do.
What do you do now, man?
So I under Jeremy there, I work on our small game program. So basic or game species that are not deer, bear, or moose.
Yeah. How's that working out for you?
Pretty good.
Is
pretty exciting.
More or less exciting than the migratory birds?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I mean, I'm always going to be known as a waterfowl guy, but, you know, they're near and dear to my heart. But
that's funny.
It's really neat to learn about new species and learn about our management and be involved in that. So it's been a really exciting.
So you're known
transition.
As the waterfowl guy. I'm just known as a fowl guy. I don't know. It's all right. So listen. One thing I did talk to your press guy, Jeff Warnick, about a little bit when we were setting up the show. I'm sorry if I'm discombobulated. We just had an hour meeting on just various things that have been going on. It was an all-staff meeting. And if there's one thing that I hate, it's a meeting. I despise them. And got out about 3 minutes before the show. So
thanks for meeting with us.
You guys are all right. You guys, this is fun. This is fun time. One thing I talked to Jeff Warnick about was this new slogan for young wildlife, if you care, leave them there, and explain what that means.
Sure. Actually, nothing new about that slogan. We've been using it for years, but every springtime, it's the time of birth, and it's the time where wildlife are giving birth to young wildlife, and people see them. And so the slogan, if you care, leave them there, really means let wildlife be wildlife. It's very tempting to find a baby rabbit and bring it in the house, or a baby raccoon or a baby squirrel and bring it in the house and take it as a pet. It's really common for fawns to be seen, particularly late May, early June. They are very young and look very, very incapable of survival on their own.
I saw one splayed out on all four legs, just belly down in the dirt one time.
Yeah, and typically for fawns, particularly when they're really young, the doe is nowhere near them. And so people find them and think, oh, this fawn's been abandoned by the doe. I need to protect it. In reality, that's a natural part of being a deer. The doe is going to spend several hours, 3, 4, sometimes 6 hours away from the fawn, feeding and whatnot, and letting the fawn just sit tight. And then she'll come back and nurse the fawn and then maybe relocate. But that leaves that fawn open to be found by a person because they're often along hedgerows or maybe in someone's backyard. And that fawn's perfectly fine until it gets picked up and fawn nap.
So predators are not an issue then?
Well, certainly. Predators might find them. But our advice to everybody is take a picture, make sure the dog isn't out, and leave it alone, and the doe will come back and walk off with the fawn. But it can't do that if you take the fawn away.
The number here is 800-348-2551. At least I know their names. I didn't know exactly what they do anymore, but Jeremy Hurst and Josh Stiller are here from the New York State DEC. The number is 800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Josh Stiller, what is Snapshot and why?
So that's a really exciting new program that we have trying to recruit the public to help us monitor wildlife populations, particularly mammals and then turkeys and potentially grouse and other species. And so we know that there are thousands and thousands of people out there that are putting out trail cameras to for their hunting reasons or just because they want to see wildlife in their backyard. It's really neat to put out a camera and see what walks by, you know, maybe only 100 yards behind your house that you never see during the daytime or you never see. And so what this program is if you go to the website for the program, it's in cooperation with Cornell University and the Cooperative Extension Unit there. And we're looking for people to put out trail cameras in a specific way and then leave it and then upload photos that they get. And so from that, we can understand how many there are in the landscape with some statistical magic, we'll call it. But
how convinced are you the statistical magic is good and accurate?
It is. Yeah, so what these community scientist projects allow us to do is be overwhelmed by data. So I think in a perfect world, you would always have structured surveys where you know exactly how they're put out. And that's the gold standard.
Yeah.
But the reality is you can, by like subsampling and some other ways, you can get by all of those biases or a lot of them. You can overcome and get reliable harvest independent indices is what we call them, is kind of the jargony word for it. But yeah, it just allows the public to be involved in management. You know, you could liken it to what they do at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology with their eBird, which is just hugely popular and a tremendous data source that's being used more and more by managers to manage our wildlife species, and it allows the public to be involved.
Have you been able to glean anything new that you were surprised by?
So I would love to say that we're there yet, but we're just launching this program. So literally the website just went live. It's snapshotny.org.
Snapshotny.org.
Correct.
Right.
And so that is how folks can sign up to be part of this. So it's, you know, it's in its infancy, and we're going to be, along with the citizen science component, DEC ourselves are already in the process of placing out hundreds of these camera sites all over the state to monitor wildlife populations.
So, okay, wait. Now, you're putting out camera sites, but you're also asking people who have trail cams to join in.
Correct, because they're already out there on the landscape. People are already doing this.
How many people have trail cams, you think? Has there been any number on
at
that?
At least six.
You know what? That's not helpful. I'm already not in a good mood, and now you're making it worse.
We don't have any estimate
but
of that.
But, I mean, how many have signed up?
Well, actually, do you know that right
now? I mean, literally this week it launched,
so we haven't done outreach yet.
We're just starting. This was a great opportunity to make folks aware of the site's existence and start that outreach. We're going to be doing a lot of informational videos and things like that. And so our social media, we'll be doing a lot of work with them to make folks aware of the program. And, you know, there's other examples of programs similar to these in Wisconsin and other states that are doing these types of programs, trying to make use of all the data that's out there that's currently just sitting on someone's memory card.
Very interesting.
Now, to what Josh said, you know, we're putting out cameras ourselves in a structured fashion. And the work that we're doing ourselves will be helpful for some species to be able to assess both the distribution as well as the abundance. In some species, particularly those that have really broad, large home ranges like black bear, bobcat, it will be helpful to have even more cameras beyond the grids that we lay out. And so when we work with the public together, we can magnify the amount of information that we get from the
interesting
project.
Number here is 800-348-2551. We're joined by Jeremy Hurst and Josh Stiller from the New York State DEC. And we'll get to your phone calls. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Before we do that and before we take a break, just quickly, we did a news piece. There was some copy that was in the newsroom. I don't know if it was this week or last week, about changes to the deer hunting regulations. And I said, do you know anything about it? And Jeremy said, yeah, I wrote them. So why don't you tell me what changed and why it's important that it happened?
Yeah, so these are just proposals at the moment. And so they're out for public review. There are several elements, but one of the primary is that we are proposing to create a system where hunters can use a fully electronic system to carry their license and their hunting tags for white-tailed deer, black bear, and turkey. And
I mean, on their phone.
Yeah, on a mobile device. And so they wouldn't have to have any paper products. They wouldn't have to have a license on their person other than what's on their phone. And if they are successful, then they can report it via their phone. Even if they don't have cell service, it would be stored on board and distributed later. And that would be sufficing as tagging the animal. Currently and historically, hunters always had to apply a physical tag to a harvested deer or bear or turkey. It's not that much of an inconvenience, but if a hunter is just taking the deer home and processing them themselves, this would save them from having to do anything with paper. They could just leave it on their phone, and that would be enough.
Very interesting. And I mean, wouldn't a tag give you more confidence if you're a hunter that, okay, this one's mine?
It is. You're right. And so the issue here is that as long as you stay with that carcass or it stays in your possession, it's at your house, you don't need it because you've got the record of that tag on your phone.
Yeah.
But if you take it somewhere else, say you're going to process the deer at a friend's house or drop it off at a commercial processor, then you need to make a tag that you attach to it so that we can recognize that that animal belongs to you.
Now, as far as enforcement goes, and I'm not a hunter, so I don't know, but are there enforcement agents who will go out and if somebody's hunting bear, let's say, when's the season for that?
In the fall.
Okay. And will there be a spot check? Hey, let me see your license.
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, we have officers all around the state, and they spend a tremendous amount of time doing that in the fall.
The number here is 800-348-2551. We'll get to your calls in just a moment and your emails. It's Jeremy Hurst at Josh Stiller from the New York DEC. We'll be back. Danny Gatton doing the old Simpsons theme here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551. We're joined by Josh Stiller and Jeremy Hurst from the New York DEC. The number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Kathleen writes in, "This is the time of year when local turtles cross roads, migrating from one place to another. Many are hit by cars. Is there any way to keep them safe? Are there any road signs available, as there are for deer crossings, to warn people about their presence?" They're pointing at each other.
Yeah, well, good question. You're right. This is the time when turtles are going to be seen along roadways. And so we always advocate to slow down and save a turtle. And if it's safe, you can pull over and actually help the turtle get across the road, or at least wave your arms and slow other people down to avoid having them find the turtle.
Couldn't that be dangerous?
That's why I said, if it's safe.
Yeah.
Well, snapping turtles, you want to just let them walk across on their own.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard, I think, to put signs up in a lot of places because turtles are all, particularly snapping turtles, are all over across the state.
Yeah.
But we do have some areas where we have threatened and endangered populations of turtles, and there we go to great lengths to protect those species and try to, even some cases, put up drift fences to keep them from the roads. But if there's an area that you've noticed that there's a wetland near a road and there's constant activity for turtles crossing, certainly you can talk to your town and the highway control folks about putting up a sign for turtles.
How long is the danger time, the migration time?
Well, generally, turtles will often nest, particularly snapping turtles, in some of the gravelly banks that are alongside roadways. And so once they lay their eggs, then they're going to move on, and then those turtles will hatch, and those hatchlings will be vulnerable too. So it would be midsummer here is when the turtles are nesting, when the ground gets nice and warm to be able to incubate those eggs.
The number here is 800-348-2551. Let's jump to the phones. And you know that when we begin in Argyle with Merle, it's going to be a fabulous show. So let's start right in Argyle. Hello, Merle. How you doing?
I'm doing very good. I'm glad I'm back on. This has to do with, just for your information, I saved two water turtles, painted turtles, so far this year.
Congrats.
Getting them across the road. All right. This has to do with otters, river otters.
River otters.
Yeah. And a sighting nowhere near a river. Well, I'm looking at the map. It's about a half mile from, this is in Clifton Park. It's a quarter mile from Stony Creek Reservoir and about a half mile from the
Mohawk,
the Erie River, or whatever.
Okay,
fair enough. Mohawk River.
Right. Okay.
Way off. There's no big creeks or rivers nearby.
Interesting. Well, fellas, do otters get lost? Do they have bad direction sense?
It's not even that. I mean, it can be just dispersing. I mean, so they can end up through the woods. We're speaking of trail cameras there a little bit ago. I mean, I've had pictures of river otters nowhere close to water. It's definitely surprising when you see it, but it happens, especially while they're dispersing. You know, if there's no good creeks and things like that for them to follow, you know, eventually they're going to have to move somehow across land. And, there's also the possibility. Are you confident it was an otter? Because that's the real challenge with mammals. It can be a challenge.
No question it was an otter.
Okay.
For sure.
Would they follow a creek that's only a foot or 2 feet wide?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Merle, one time I saw an otter slide in the wintertime, which is, if you haven't seen that, that's pretty remarkable, too. But I was way up in the Adirondacks on a ridgetop, not in the high peaks, but probably at about 2,000-foot elevation, and way above where there were any of the creeks. And that otter had come over top of the ridge, and then, of course, I saw the slide through the snow as it made its way down to the valley.
Oh, fantastic. Hey, wow. Merle, you live out in the sticks. Do you have a trail cam?
No. That's beyond my capability.
Oh, well, I hear that, man. Oh, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. 800-348-2551. Josh Stiller, Jeremy Hurst are here from the New York State DEC. We talk about wildlife on the program today. And let's go to Glenville. Bill, you're on.
One second.
Oh,
you there?
Sure. Yeah, take your time.
Hello?
Hello, yeah. I'm here. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I got a question about the proposed, I heard this from some friends. We were texting, but is there a proposal for the bow hunting to change the regulations to allow crossbows in the bow-only areas?
Bill, what you're referring to is some recent legislation that was proposed and then signed by or passed by the Assembly and the Senate, but it has not been adopted into law yet by the governor. So the bills as proposed would expand the use of crossbows during the archery season and allow use of crossbows in areas that historically have been limited to vertical bows only.
Right. Is there any thinking why they went with that?
Yeah, I can't comment on the pending legislation, and I would encourage you to reach out to your elected officials who were involved in that.
All right, Bill.
Okay.
Good.
All right.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to Hudson. And Mike, you're on.
Well, hey, guys. I'm hoping you can hear me. I'm driving.
Yeah. You're all right.
I heard DEC was on. It's sort of an ancillary wildlife question. I own a 5-acre wetland in Catskill. And we have lots of little newts and salamanders and snakes and frogs and turtles and stuff. My issue is that when I bought it, and I knew this was the case, it has a large shack and a car. It's kind of sinking into the wetland. I'm not supposed to drive across it, so I have to find a way to get this stuff out of there so it doesn't sort of sink into the wetland. I'm wondering if there's someone who I can call for information on how to sort of work with this stuff.
Yeah, it's a good question, Mike, and good for you thinking about trying to get that stuff out of there. I would start with our regional office in Schenectady. You're in Hudson, which is in our Region 4.
Yep.
Our Region 4 headquarters office is in Schenectady, and our ecosystem health folks oversee the wetlands program, and they can give you some guidance as to whether you would need a permit or the best time of year, best method to get that stuff out without damaging the wetland, or at least minimizing the damage to the wetland. I don't have the number offhand, but you can search DEC Schenectady, and you'll be given a list of phone numbers there. It's our ecosystem health office.
All right, Mike.
Yep. I can take it from here. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop outside, metaphorically speaking, with Jeremy Hurst and Josh Stiller. And let's go to Accord, New York. Sally, you're on.
Hi. I worked in a veterinary hospital in Greenwich, Connecticut for 5.5 years. And I learned about turtles. I wasn't going to say anything, but the lady who said about the turtles crossing the road at this time of the year, you can pretty much pick up the painter turtles pretty easily, but the snapping turtles, if they're smallish, you can hover over them and they'll kind of move by themselves. They don't like to be picked up. And snapping turtles should not ever be picked up by their tail because it's part of their spine and you can really damage them. So I have a special box that I kind of shove them in. And one was trying to cross Route 28 up towards Woodstock area. And I was able, fortunately, a state trooper stopped. And I said, I know what I'm doing. Just she stopped all the traffic so I could get the, you know. But you worry about them coming back, you know, because they go across the to lay the eggs and then they come back, but I wasn't staying around for that. And the other thing, I was studying to be a wildlife rehabilitator with Dara Madonna of Wildlife and Crisis in Wilton, Connecticut. And she said that the deer, the reason why the mother deer leaves the baby deer alone is because the baby deer at that time doesn't have any scent. And the mother deer doesn't want to bring her scent to that area with the baby deer at that time. What's the other thing? Oh, about geese. They were having lots of problems with, they said they had too many Canadian geese, and they were kind of messing up the parks where the kids couldn't play soccer anymore because there was so much geese poop.
Splendid.
So what they did, they hired Geese Peace, which has these dogs that are trained to chase the geese. I think they're border collies, but not to get them or anything, but just, and they would do it at different times of the day, so the geese couldn't get used to a regular pattern.
Amazing.
And they would even put them in the canoes with them, and the geese would, you know,
the
be
dogs
a little
had canoes.
So no, they would put the people, the Geese Peace guys
splendid.
Paddle the canoes, and they would have a dog in the canoe with them, and they'd go around by the geese. So the geese learned, you know, even if they couldn't even come at certain times of the day because the Geese Peace would change the times of the day.
Hmm.
So they would still have geese. They just didn't have like 1,000 of them, you know, right there.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't about killing the geese. It was a Geese Peace. It was how do we work it out? So there can still be geese, but, you know, not the volume that the kids can't even use the park to play soccer or anything because it was such a mess.
Oh, that's nice.
So it really helped a lot.
Is there
and,
a, do you have
I think a... they went over to one of my friend's house. We had a pond behind her house. And there were like 1,000 geese behind her house. So I think that's where they probably went in Greenwich.
So there's geese
anyway.
Poo somewhere. Do you have any questions for the fellas?
No, I'm just so grateful that they're educating everybody because it's just so important, especially with the turtles right now. It's important to put your blinkers on and stop the car and stop traffic and everything.
Yeah.
Well, Sally, thank you for the additional
really
advice there about the turtles.
Yeah, that's nice. That's,
yeah.
Thank
okay.
you. Sally, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551. Now, it's an all-star program when we have Merlin Argyle and Jim and Madam Morris on one show. Hello, Jim. You're on.
Is MP99 still being used as a general anesthetic for large animals, such as bears?
Not by us.
What's MT99?
Jim, you want to answer
it's
that?
It's an injectable anesthetic. They usually shoot it with a blowgun or a dart gun.
Jesus.
Yeah, Jim, we do occasionally have to chemically immobilize animals, whether that be a bear or a deer. In fact, we train our staff in that every year, working with vets to go through that training. For most of the wildlife, we use a ketamine or xylazine mix or a etilazole mix. In some cases, some other cocktails of anesthetics and agents to help dissociate them from what's going on, with reversal agents when it's appropriate so that we can wake them back up as quick as possible.
Okay. Jim, thanks a lot. By the way, how did MT-99 come onto your radar? Just want to know.
Well, they used it in veterinary school when I was a junior. Seniors used it, and they killed the pony with it because they accidentally hit a carotid artery.
Ouch. Okay. Well, Jim, I'm sorry about the pony, and thank you very much. Do you guys use blowguns? That sounds...
Sometimes.
Really?
Not very often, but... You know, it depends on the scenario. Sometimes you can use a jab stick, which is a long pole with a syringe at the end that you can kind of approach the animal and jab it. Often do that if we're working with a bear in a den. In some cases, we use a dart projectors, either as a pistol form or a rifle form that are either CO2 compressed air powered or charged with a 22 blank. And some kinds of blowguns. And it all depends on the scenario. What's the best implement?
like in the movies, where it's a long read and you just blow the thing.
Yeah, a little bit higher tech than that, but it's essentially the same thing.
How lovely, how primitive. 800-348-2551. We're joined by Jeremy Hurst and Josh Stiller today. It's from the New York State DEC. Let's go to Schenectady. Willie, how you doing?
Oh, I'm fine, guys. As long as we're on the educational kick, I wanted to help make a correction earlier.
Sure.
One of the callers called them Canadian geese. There are no such things as Canadian geese.
You're
They're
right, sir.
Citizens of Canada, Canada geese.
Yep. Exactly.
Having said that, I'll move on to my question. Of my caution is, I was working in Missouri or Arkansas. I forget which one. On my way to work, and an armadillo was crossing the road, and I was tempted to stop and help him across. I got to work and I shared my thoughts with the guys there. They said, oh, no, Willie, you don't want to do that. Those things can jump 4 feet in the air. And 80% of all leprosy cases in the United States comes from having contact with armadillos.
What the blue blazes? Really?
So
they're moving north something like 5 miles per year. I don't think we are in threat in New York State, but we want that practice to be carried too far and helping animals across the road.
All right, hang on, yeah. Willie. Is it true if you can get leprosy from an armadillo?
So I will definitely not claim to be a armadillo expert or anything about zoonotics that are potentially coming from them. But in general, I mean, I think that's our guidance all the time when it comes to wildlife. You're best off not handling wildlife, interacting with wildlife. Like, we want you to enjoy wildlife, but do it from a reasonable distance. You know, it's the same reason that, you know, you go out west and they're asking folks to stay back from the bison or the grizzly bear or the black bear in New York State or the deer, whatever it is. In general, you know, wildlife, we want them to remain wild because usually it's not good for them when they're not.
The number here is 800-348-2551. Jay writes in, I recently observed closer than I liked a bear take a fawn. I heard the fawn bleeding nearby and turning around saw a bear appear out of the tall grass with limp fawn draped in its jaws. I'm quite sure it was very dead. I was actually about to set up a trail cam as two of my birdhouses mounted on 6-foot metal poles had been bent to the ground and ripped apart. Figured it was probably a bear. That's a pretty violent bear. Will they go for that?
Oh, sure. Yeah. There's been a bunch of studies that have looked at fawn survival and what are the key predators for fawns. And so in New York, it's black bear, coyote, and bobcat as the primary predators for fawns. I mean, deer clearly, as a population, are able to sustain that level of predation. It's not so nice for the individual fawn, though. But, yeah, bear will take some.
Amazing. I mean, I thought bears are omnivores, then?
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
Yeah, probably most of their meat consumption comes as scavenging animals that are already dead. But during that fawn period that we talked about when fawns are laying fairly helpless, particularly the first couple of weeks, they're mobile, but they're unsteady on their legs and they're not very fleet. Bears can actually run quite fast, and so they can take a fawn pretty easily. I would suspect that bears are not necessarily hunting fawns, but more when they're opportunistic, when they encounter them. Some bears may learn. One of the things that we learned in a study we did with coyotes was that coyotes actually became specialists. Some coyotes, individuals, became really adept at getting fawns, whereas other coyotes focused on rabbits or woodchucks. And so I suspect in some cases that may be the same for bear.
What does that tell you about the intelligence level of some of these creatures out in the woods? You see them all the time. You guys see them all the time. Do we seriously, as humans, being the egomaniacal species that we are, do we underestimate the intelligence of the fauna and out there?
Well, we certainly know that animals have capability of learning, and bears are a really good example for this. And so the caller wrote about, spoke about the bird feeders, right?
Yeah.
Bears are really good about learning where they get easy access to food and those conditions. And that might be that there is a particular ridge on a hillside 20 miles away that has acorns. And they'll remember that and cycle back to that property or that place. And they may remember a neighborhood that they can get easy access to garbage on Thursday mornings at 3 a.m. because people put their garbage cans out on Wednesday night. And they'll go back to that spot.
That's an individual bear. Now, you were talking about coyotes who became specialized at hunting fawns, right?
Some did, yeah.
is there institutional memory? Can it be passed from generation to generation, or does each coyote have to learn it on its own?
Well, so the capability to learn would be passed from generation, but the actual information about one coyote learning, it very well could be that an adult would be teaching juveniles, and that kind of information get passed on that way.
Very interesting.
You know, that we see the same thing with deer, where particularly in northern latitudes in the Adirondacks and other parts of northern states, deer will migrate in wintertime to better habitat conditions for the winter. And that's a learned destination. The impulse to migrate is not learned. That's intrinsic and sort of a survival mechanism. But the travel route and the destination may be learned. And so when we have a series of really mild winters, we may have some generations of deer that don't learn that information quite as well.
Okay, let's take a quick break. 800-348-2551 is the number. Josh Stiller's here, and Jeremy Hurst is here. They're from the New York State DEC. We'll be back with more of your calls and emails in a moment. Fox Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551. There's Bill Watrous and the Manhattan Wildlife Refuge, old big band from the 70s. We're joined today by Jeremy Hurst and Josh Stiller. And Stephen writes in, armadillos are the only animal other than humans that get leprosy.
Cool.
Who knew? That is strange. All right, let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Matt is in Hampton. Matt, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm an avid outdoorsman, and I've recently taken up spring turkey hunting, which I've enjoyed immensely. But this year, it was just so wet. Everything seemed to be really off. You know, there wasn't a lot of activity with the toms and pursuing the hens, and I couldn't see where anything was nesting. So my question really is, as wet as it was, I know turkeys will lose, you know, their eggs in a wet spring. Do you think that do they actually put off the laying of eggs? Conditions aren't ideal because I did hear a lot.
Yeah, so you're breaking up a little bit there, but I think I got your question. And definitely, this year is probably going to be a pretty rough year for turkey reproduction. We're seeing a lot of ground nesting birds. You know, when you get that rain at the wrong time, whether that's when the poults are really young and freshly hatched, or swamping nests when it floods out, you know, that happens to waterfowl, that happens to upland game birds like turkeys. And, you know, we do monitor that. So in August, if you're out, you see turkey poults, whether they're with poults or without, we do have a reporting form online. It's really helpful and helps us monitor it. And it does track really well with, we can look at spring environmental conditions and link that to what we think productivity will be and what it ends up being.
Interesting. Matt.
Yeah. Watch out for the armadillos. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks, man. Appreciate the call. You know, it's funny, and this is only my perception, but it seems like we go through phases where there are a lot of turkeys flying around, and then there's phases, and I think I haven't seen one in a couple few years in my neighborhood.
Yeah, so that's a common question we have. We have a lot of good indices for populations. With this Snapshot New York program, we're hoping to get another that's not related to harvest, that's just related to how many turkeys are out there.
Yeah.
They definitely are cyclical. I mean, a lot of birds and species that are egg laying, you know, they have boom bust type productivity.
Yeah.
Turkeys are pretty boom. Like they usually have good reproduction. In New York, we see a lot higher reproductive rates than you see in some of the southern states and some of the Midwestern states.
Why
that have been experiencing declines. I mean, we have a lot of great habitat, and in some cases, we have lower predator communities than some of these other places that are experiencing. Like in New York, an average hen has about 2.8 or so, ballpark number, poults. And then you look at some of these other states that are further south that have declining populations, more so than New York, and their poults per hen are closer to like 1, 1.5.
Oh.
So they produce a lot fewer.
Well, I look forward to this Snapshot NY. Okay, you're going to get data. Are you going to release it and collate
yes.
it and make it all available for those of us in the general population?
Yeah, so that's something we're trying to do a better job of. We know, you know, it's hard to develop all those tools to get the information in a digestible format back to folks. But if you look at our website, we're doing a lot of work with creating these data dashboards, we call them. And so it's a map where you can see whether it's harvest data, whether it's data from this new program. Also, like, we're doing a lot more online surveys of hunters and the general public, and then we're trying to do a better job of providing feedback and actually results from the survey, because, you know, I think it's something that we can do better at, and we're trying to actively do better to get that information, because that encourages folks to participate more is when they're actually seeing the results of their efforts.
It sounds like fun, though. I mean, eBird always sounded like fun when I never got around to doing it, but, you know, but this sounds like a lot of fun as well. Josh Stiller, Jeremy Hurst are joining us. Let's go back to our phone lines, 800-348-2551. Let's go to Niskayuna already. Bill, you're on.
Good afternoon, guys. Thanks, Jeremy and Josh and Ray, for taking my call.
You bet.
I'd like to time my visits to the Great Blue Heron Rookery in Westerloo in order to observe chicks and feeding activity and that stuff. I visited in June 23 and observed about 30 nests with chicks in the nest and adults perched nearby or even in the nest. But when I went back in June of 24, not a single of those nests were occupied. So I'm wondering, you know, is there an optimal time of the year to observe these great blue heron chicks, you know, nesting, fledging, et cetera?
Well, I wish I could say I knew the exact timing of their egg laying and their brooding activity. That's something that, again, I'd go to a source like the Cornell All About Birds. They have a website that goes through and it lays out the exact timing of that, usually by region, and that could give you a good idea. I mean, I would think that it'd be right about now. There should be great blue herons with young in nests.
Yeah, I'm surprised that within one day there was that much of a remarkable difference in what you
observed. No, 1 year.
Oh, okay.
1 year.
Well, yeah, then that.
So 23. So 23, as you recommended.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Prior to my first visit, Cornell says get there around June because of the sort of breeding cycle. So
yeah,
I did that, and it was successful. When I went back in June 24, there wasn't a single heron in that whole rookery.
Right, I gotcha. So what you're seeing is just that even though animals are generally consistent by time of year when they go through their breeding cycles, it's going to vary from week to week, and that's going to be determined in part by the timing of migration and the timing of the environmental conditions and when they're setting their nests up. And so the best case is just to check back regularly through the month of June.
Sure.
All right, Bill, thank you for the call. It's 800-348-2551. H writes in, my friend seems to think they saw a group of sturgeon lapping up on the shore of Tivoli Bays. Do you think they were lost? I thought sturgeon were deep water fish. Is it normal to see them close to shore? Should he have called the DEC? How are the sturgeon doing in the Hudson? And that's from H.
So I believe there is a report form. I'm not sure for live sturgeon. There's definitely a report form on our website from that's a whole different division that deals with marine species. But they definitely come up the Hudson. They definitely spawn in the Hudson. And that's often when you see them. I just recently saw a video someone posted from the Niagara River with a bunch of sturgeon.
They can be quite large, right?
Yeah, they can get huge. Like 7-8 feet for the species that we have in New York, but don't quote me on that.
You're allowed to catch them, or can anglers catch them or not?
Ooh, that's
they're protected in New York.
They are. Okay. Let's go back to our phone lines, 800-348-2551. Marsha's in Claremont. Hello, Marsha in Claremont.
Hello, Ray. Thanks for taking my call. I hope you gentlemen are staying cool today.
More or less.
We can do what we can do.
Right.
Just a quick comment about, I think it was Sally, and she was talking about the border collies and the geese.
Yeah.
They actually, I think, they have been doing that in Central Park and in the city for ages to keep, particularly Sheep's Meadow, where a lot of people like to go and sunbathe. So those are the only dogs that are allowed there now.
Huh.
And I have a question about wolves. I know that there was a wolf shot. It was determined it was finally a wolf. The hunter thought it was a coyote. Back in 2021 around Cherry Valley, have there been any other sightings?
Not since then, not that we're aware of.
Were there any prior?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Were there any prior? Because the reason why I ask is my husband saw a huge uncollared animal and definitely no signs of a collar 20 years prior, not far, like around the Germantown Red Hook area, just crossing back and forth, and there were a pen of chickens that the people had, and he was eyeing those chickens, and my husband literally stopped and watched this animal, and it was huge. It was definitely a canid.
Yeah. So, have been several.
And then when he got too close.
There's been several on the order of 3 or 4 instances over the last 20 to 30 mm-hmm. years where we have believable and verifiable evidence of wolves in New York State. Not all thought to have come in naturally. So the closest existing populations of wolves would be in Ontario. There are also Midwestern wolves. And so the wolf that, the animal that was determined to be a wolf in 2021 had genetic ancestry related to the group in the upper Midwest, huh. Great Lakes area. And so that wolf made a long distance journey to get to New York. And so we have been requesting and providing information to hunters and trappers as they are out and about to give them more information about how to determine the difference between a coyote and a wolf, and certainly to let us know anytime there is a large canid sighted that we can do some work to understand what's happening.
Marcia, thank you very much. You said some came in from out of state, but some people had them as pets?
Yeah, there are some facilities that may have them for exhibition that an animal could escape. And historically, there may have been opportunity for people to purchase them as a pup on the black market and release them. And so there are situations, there's every permutation of way animals can get into the state.
Why would you want to have a pet wolf?
Well, wolves are actually really tricky because their genetic relatedness amongst dogs, it is a soup.
Oh, yeah,
we talked about this before.
Right?
And so determining whether an animal is really a wolf genetically is not straightforward. And some of our large dog breeds have wolf ancestry as well. And so it can be really difficult visually to determine whether what you're seeing is a wolf, and even really difficult genetically.
Number here is 800-348-2551. Back to the phones with Jeremy Hurst and Josh Stiller. Bonnie's in Hudson. Bonnie.
Hi, how are you?
Good, welcome.
Thank you. Okay, I have a question about bear behavior. For the first time in 26 years of living in the area, there was a bear right out front, right outside my front door, my window. I'm sitting here, sitting on the couch, doing the crossword puzzle, drinking my coffee, and I saw some movement out of my peripheral vision, looked up, and first I thought it was a big black dog, and then I realized, oh my God, there's a bear. He was very calm. He walked right past the window and over to the hummingbird feeder, got on his hind legs and sniffed it, but he did not seem to have any interest in it. And then he just slunk off into the woods. So my question is, since he wasn't very interested in the hummingbird feeder, what are the chances that he's coming back?
Well, that is a good question. I'm not going to hypothesize on the odds, but if there's a bear in the area and there's food in the area, there's potential it could come back.
Yeah.
I would say the safest bet for you is to take the bird feeder down, and certainly if you have any bird feeders that have seed, take them down. Let your neighbors know that there's a bear in the area so that they can do the same. If you and your neighbors use commercial garbage collection, make sure that your garbage cans are not accessible to the bears outside, that if they come on a Tuesday or Thursday morning to pick up the garbage, that you're putting the garbage out right before they come and not the night before, those types of things. We want to make sure that there's not any food or what a bear may perceive as food in the area that's going to keep the bear coming back. Certainly not going to come back for your crossword puzzle.
Go ahead, Bonnie.
The hummingbird feeder is old and it smells like rust. Is it possible he was turned off by the rust and won't come back? I mean, but
yeah, I don't know
garbage,
what the reason why the bear would pass on the bird feeder. There's a lot of sugar in that water, and so I'm surprised that it just didn't break it down. But who knows? I can't think like a bear. But there are a lot of reasons why bears come into people's yards. And so I would say look over your space and talk with your neighbors and see if you can reduce anything that a bear might see as food and clean it up for the time being.
Right.
All right, Bonnie, thanks a lot for the call. You know, a couple of years ago you were on, I think the day that a bear was sighted in Albany over by the park. And I think I saw later in the week that basically you tracked this bear and you knew where it came from. How well do you know where these populations of bears are in upstate New York?
Well, we know where bears are generally. We don't necessarily know where individuals are. I think in the case that you're referring to, we had a bear that got into Washington Park in Albany.
Yep, and it was on a tree. It was something.
It was a big ordeal.
Yeah.
But that particular bear, we had some evidence that it had come up through Glenmont in areas where bears are less commonly seen. And so because we had staff that were keeping track of reports of that bear and law enforcement was as well, we could kind of track its movement a little bit more closely than we would.
Something. Let's go to Sheffield real quick here. Ruby, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So as of actually just today, I believe that I have a turkey nesting in my backyard. I think she plopped down in a spot, found a spot, and I think she's been laying eggs. So I'm kind of curious. I'm excited, and I'm also kind of curious, like, what I should or should not do. Will she, like, leave the nest for periods when I could possibly potentially mow the rest of my yard, or will that completely scare her away? Like, can I go outside and visit my vegetable garden? I don't want to scare her away from her nest.
Yeah, so, I mean, whatever you can do to minimize disturbance to the bird, the greater likelihood that they're going to be successful. The reality is birds and bird nests are not very successful on the ground, unfortunately. There's a lot of predators, but so... And I would also, like, when you're mowing, try to avoid leaving her out on an island or something like that, where literally she's in the only vegetation in the yard or something like that. Like, leave the harder it is for a fox or a raccoon to find her nest, the better off her odds are. And the less you go near it and kind of drag scent over there, like, you don't want to be walking up to it or anything like that.
Yeah.
You want to give it some clearance, and also definitely if you have pets.
Ruby,
don't let them out.
You know what this means, Ruby. This means you've been told by officials not to mow your lawn. So relax. Rest easy. That's one less thing you have to.
That's great.
You're saving the turkeys, my friend.
I wasn't mowing the
days.
Back part anyway.
Well,
so.
Good for you. Well, congrats on that. We're going to have to.
Well, thank you. I'm excited. I hope I get to see it all happen.
Cool. Well, thanks for calling. We're about out of time here. All right, fellas. Wonderful job, as always. Once again, to find out about Snapshot and why, how do we go do that?
Just keep an eye out on our we have a GovDelivers message that you can sign up for about general wildlife issues and about hunting and trapping newsletters. And also just check out that website. It gives you all the information on how to sign up, what the program is about.
What's the website, Josh?
You know what?
Snapshot.
You're a wise guy.
Snapshotny.org.
Jeremy Hurst, what are you going to be doing now?
Today?
No. Where's your next big assignment?
Next big assignment. Well, we got to process all these regulations that are happening.
Okay. Oh, so you got a desk job now.
Oh, yeah.
How sad. This is how careers end. All right. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here. Support comes from Shedmen, offering sheds, garages, gazebos, and horse barns for nearly 40 years. Set up and delivered. Inventory at shedman.com. Daughters of Sarah, Albany, New York, providing a continuum of care for seniors, offering them opportunities to live and age gracefully with dignity and respect. Daughtersofsarah.org. And WAMC on the Road, WAMC's new programming initiative, bringing public radio in person throughout the WAMC listening area and face-to-face with listeners in their own communities. Once you see my face, you probably won't do it again. WAMC.org for more information. We'll see you out there on the road and whatnot. Thanks again to Jeremy Hurst and Josh Stiller for being here from the New York State DEC. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Zach Malloy, who's a wild animal over there in Master Control. Ed Rosen screened the calls. He's still on the phone. Well, the show's over, Ed. Relax, buddy. Tomorrow, it's Pets and Vets. Dr. Carrie O'Loughlin joins us. We'll see you tomorrow at 2:00.